The Work Lab podcast from Microsoft answers the questions that keep business leaders up at night. Like, how can I reinvent processes for the AI era, from customer service to sales to HR? How can I prepare for AI to fundamentally transform jobs, companies, industries, and the whole economy? Don't panic. Tune in. Each episode of Work Lab brings you the top experts, hard data, and actionable insights to help you future-proof your organization. Check out Work Lab, that's W-O-R-K-L-A-B, no spaces, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Seneca Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina offers a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. Download the app or subscribe to the daily newsletter to get a daily dose of news that will keep you on top of what's happening in China. We are coming to you this week from the studios of the Council on Foreign Relations in Manhattan. I'm Jeremy Goldkorn, joined, of course, by shampoo advertisement model and former minister for the suppression of barbarian lies for Baidu, Kaiser Guo. How you doing, KK?
Ying dog. I'm all right, man. I'm good. I'm enjoying my time here in New York, definitely. So today, we are joined by Rob Schmitz, who has been radio correspondent for Marketplace in Shanghai since 2010. You know, you've heard him on our show before. He was the guy who came on to destroy utterly the fabulous Mike Daisy, who made up all sorts of idiotic stories about children working in iPhone factories. So, hey, you were a Peace Corps volunteer in 1995. You've worked as a journalist both in the U.S. and in Asia since then. So how are you, Rob, man?
Good to have you back. I'm well. Thank you. Thank you for having me on. This is a market improvement, this studio, from your last dig.
I dare say it is. It's unfortunately not our permanent home. But so today you're here to talk about your new book, The Street of Eternal Happiness, which The Economist has called A Portrait of China from the Stories of a Single Shanghai Street, a Poignant Microcosm. And the New York Times review noted that Schmitz's eye for scenes and ear for dialogue give an immediacy to his stories. Welcome back to Seneca, man. It's good to
Thank you. It's great to be back here.
So let's set the scene, Rob. When did you move to Changlulu, which you've translated as the Street of Eternal Happiness? And what can you tell us about the neighborhood?
I moved to Changlulu it was in July of 2010. I had just been assigned the Marketplace China correspondent, and we moved my wife and my now eldest son, but we only had one son back then, Rainey. We moved to this, by far, the least interesting place on the street, a complex called The Summit, which is a kind of a large apartment complex covered in white bathroom tiles.
As so many buildings are.
it was like the kind of the hallmark of the 90s and 2000s kind of architectural style in China. And from there, I started to explore a little. And this was an interesting time in Shanghai because, you know, 2010 was the year that Shanghai hosted the World's Fair. And, you know, Shanghai had done a lot of building to get to that point. They had built all these subway lines. They had sort of rebuilt the city, constructed the city, you know, for 20 years before that. The whole city was sort of a big construction site. And there it was, ready. And so I arrived amidst a pretty interesting kind of background. And Changlulu, the street that I ended up focusing on, is a street inside the former French concession of Shanghai. You know, the French set up this neighborhood around 150 years ago. It's sort of distinctive because it has, you know, these trees that sort of line, the London plane trees that line all of the boulevards in the neighborhood. You guys have been there, obviously, and you know this place.
And a lot of foreigners like to live there.
They do. Mm. Yeah, a lot of foreigners like to live there. Foreigners set it up, and so it attracts foreigners now, you know, with a nice little break in between those two foreigner periods.
But your book, of course, is not really about foreigners. It's about...
It is not. No, I 2 years after I arrived, you know, I'm the only correspondent from Marketplace, and I cover China's economy. And I wanted to sort of take a step back from the sort of brutal news cycle that you sort of get used to as a journalist in China, sort of the Twitter universe of China. And
I'm unfamiliar with this.
Yeah, are you? Yeah, sort of. And so I wanted to take a step back from that and focus on just real people. And I tried to figure out a way to do that. And I thought, well, why don't I just, you know, I wanted to take like a geographic place and just kind of focus on it, like almost like an anthropologist would over a period of time. because I wanted to do this over a year. And after a while, I just realized, you know, why don't I just focus on the street that I live on?
Because you're lazy. So
because I'm lazy.
Yeah.
Because I didn't really want to move very far.
Right.
No, and in fact, the reason I did that was because I was so busy that I, you know, basically this was the only thing I could probably manage, you know, doing these features on just normal folks who live and work along the street that I live on, this one single street in Shanghai.
And when you met these people, I mean, did you initially sort of make friends with them without telling them what your purpose was? Or did you introduce yourself as somebody who's working on a series of radio pieces?
I plan on chronicling, you know, the everyday.
Well, it's hard for me to sort of sneak up on people because I have a shotgun microphone in my hand. And so when
that's a bit of a giveaway that you're not just coming.
Not only am I
friends.
A Lawai, but I'm a Lawai with a very large microphone and it's a shotgun. So it's like this enormous microphone, this big like thing that looks like a ferret on top of it. and you know, if that's not daunting enough, you know, and for a lot of folks, you know, that was just way too much for them. They said, no way, I don't want to talk to you. But surprisingly, most people that I approached for the initial radio series were totally down with talking to me because I wasn't there to talk to them about what was going on in politics or anything like that. I just wanted to talk to them about their lives. And a lot of folks that live on the street, they own little shops. They're business owners. And so when you step into their shop, you know, that's their territory. They feel comfortable in that territory. And I would usually start by asking them questions about their business. You know, how much money are you making?
That's what Chinese people always ask me.
Exactly, right? And that's what they ask me too, right? And so I think as an economics reporter, that in some ways has been really nice because I'm, you know, the first questions aren't these really kind of sensitive questions. You know, a lot of my first questions to folks normally are, how much money do you make? How much money did you make a few years ago? How have things changed economically for you? And that's something that I think most Chinese are totally fine with answering. Because they ask me that question usually too, right?
Much easier to answer than, you know, what do you think of the government, basically.
Yeah. But, you know, after a while, you know, the questions sort of lead in that direction naturally. You know, you start talking about the economy and of course, everything's tied up in politics in China in some ways. And so I think those maybe what are considered sensitive questions start to kind of come out sometimes. And it's interesting how that happens.
Yeah, so talk a little bit about the geography of the area. I mean, so Changlulu is in the French Concession. So how does that differ from other neighborhoods of Shanghai? I mean, what's peculiar about this particular neighborhood?
Well, what's really peculiar, I think, are the trees, like I mentioned before.
The French planks,
the
right?
London plane trees, because those really, I think, and the way that they prune them still today is really distinctive. They do something that's called pollarding, which means that they basically stunt their growth over the entire lifespan of the tree so that the trees are constantly, they can't grow up. And so they grow sideways. They grow into each other, making these long green
canopies.
Tunnels.
Yeah.
Exactly. So that, and the reason that, part of the reason that they do that is to offer a lot of shade during the hot summers of Shanghai, to offer protection from the rain. And it's funny because a lot of these trees are also, they kind of look like goalposts, and the reason that they prune them that way is because when typhoons come through, the wind can go through them without knocking them down.
Right.
Yeah, and these are trees that were sort of planted throughout the civilized world in the 19th century. So you see a lot of these trees in Rome. You see them in New York City. Actually, the symbol for the Parks and Rec Department in New York is a London plane leaf.
Oh,
yeah, and so you see them especially like if you go to Bryant Park. They're planted all over Bryant Park. They're in Sydney. They're in Buenos Aires. So it's interesting. Around that time of, around that historical time, these were planted all over the place. And because they're good urban trees, they soak up smog very well. And so that's the biggest distinctive, I think, quality of this neighborhood, as well as just the way that the roads are. And the fact that I think Shanghai, the city government, has done a pretty good job, I would say, at preserving the look of the neighborhood.
Uh-huh.
I mean, there's a lot of complaints about, you know, so many things that the Shanghai government has done. But I think the one thing that they've done pretty well is they've preserved that kind of look of that section of the city. Because when you go there, it's very distinctive. But when you go to Jing'an, for example, that was the old British concession, that has a different look to it. It's more urban. It's more condensed, right? It's more dense. There's more people. You still see some trees, but it's more buildings, really.
I mean, Shanghai's government has done fairly well, I mean, in my estimation, in terms of preservation of old buildings as well. What about in gentrification? That must be happening. I mean, it's not just the foreigners who aren't necessarily the rich people anymore.
No, China, no, God,
who are moving it right.
No, I mean, most of the folks in that, you know, complex that I live in, you know, it's a nice complex. I mean, most of them are rich Chinese.
Right. And but the folks that you talk to aren't.
They're not.
Right. How are they responding to the influx of all of these wealthier people?
Well, a lot of them make their money off of this. So I think for them, it's not a bad thing, you know, because, you know, actually, see, two or three of the folks that I focus on who are main characters in the book come from somewhere else. They're YDRent. And so they came, you know, to make money in the city. And so they depend on this capital for their livelihood. You know, Zhao Shiling, one of the characters that I focus on, she's a flower shop owner. And so, you know, she not only depends on, you know, wealthy Chinese for her business, but she also depends on the government, because for a long time before Xi Jinping came into power, the government you would have the city government or the district government would have these banquets, and she would basically cater these banquets, and they'd buy so many flowers from her. And actually, after Xi Jinping came into power with the anti-corruption campaign, suddenly she lost all these orders because that was sort of seen as excessive. And so a lot of these austerity measures had a pretty interesting impact on some of the folks that I focus on in the book.
Is she unhappy about that?
She is. Yeah, I mean, this is something that I talked to her a lot about. Yeah, every time one of the biggest things that she loves to talk about, obviously, she loves to complain a lot, obviously, like you know, many people on the street, but she complains about money, you know, and she's not making as much as she used to 5-10 years ago. And that's a big problem for her. And so we actually had a very interesting conversation one time when her son was around. And her son is a really educated guy, despite the fact that he was a dropout from high school. And he's a big Xi Jinping supporter because he believes that Xi Jinping is going to kind of lead China into, you know, I think he's
something
kind of,
about a dream.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, the Chinese dream. But I think that he likes Xi Jinping because he does believe there's a lot of problems that Xi Jinping is addressing, like corruption, I think was one of his biggest complaints. But it's interesting because his mom, you know, sort of thrives off of that.
So she's pro-corruption, basically.
She's pro-money. You know, she's pro-making money. And basically, the whole system, you know, money went, you know, corruption makes the world go round in some ways, you know. And I think that that's starting to change a little.
Let's talk about some of the other characters in the book. Why don't you tell us a little bit about CK? He's quite a curious individual.
CK owns a sandwich shop on the street, and he has a pretty interesting background. I think he's the youngest character in the book. He's in his early 30s.
So CK's sandwiches and accordions or something like that.
Yeah. So he sells accordions over the phone now, and then he has a sandwich shop that he set up that basically makes no money. It's starting to make money now, though. Finally.
It's a front for the accordions.
Yeah, and so,
which are like crack. Right?
But you know, this sales combination, you know, where else but in China could you find this type of sales combination, right? This guy's like peddling sandwiches and then peddling accordions on the side, right? It's kind of crazy. But so CK grows up in Hengyang, which is a industrial city in Hunan province. And he's sort of a miserable childhood. You know, he has an abusive father. He's an only child. His parents get divorced. And this is back in the 1980s where divorce was sort of rare. And he attempted suicide when he was pretty young. I wrote about that scene in the first chapter. But then he sort of picks himself up. He's a musician. He actually is a big fan of Urs Kaiser.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Maybe he can come join us on accordion.
That would be great. And he still plays pretty well. And so he got he was able to get into university in Guangdong, and he studied the accordion. And then after he graduated, he got a job with Pearl River, which is a large state-owned enterprise that makes instruments in China. And he was on their accordion line, and he was a manager of the assembly line for accordions. It was a great job, right? This is a kind of an iron rice bowl job, and he totally got sick of it. He hated it, and he just quit.
Well, back then it was from each accordion to his needs, and to each accordion to his abilities.
Exactly, and so he quits this job, and his parents sort of, you know, his parents have already lost their jobs because this was in the 90s. His parents both worked for SOEs as well, and they both lost their jobs during the privatization of the 90s, and they were pretty angry about it. But then he found this job working for Polverini, which is an Italian quarry maker, and Polverini had sent an Italian engineer to Shanghai to start up an assembly line to make accordions in Shanghai, and he hired CK as his kind of sideman, and from there on, CK figured out how to assemble an accordion, which is a pretty difficult thing to do because these are pretty complicated instruments.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
And he had to manage an assembly line full of workers and basically teach them how to do it. So he became an engineer, you know, not by an education, not by like a university, but through doing something. He learns how to do this. He becomes a sales manager for the company inside of China. He makes a lot of money, and he probably makes more than the average American right now. So from that job, and then with that money, he establishes this sort of slightly ill-conceived sandwich shop after taking a trip to Chicago. He's inspired by he sees a sandwich shop and he thinks, this is amazing. You know, and he comes back home and decides to buy a second floor space across the street from where I live. And he calls it Second Floor Your Sandwich. And the problem is that it is on the second floor, and because of these plane trees I was just talking about, you can't see it. It's completely invisible. You know, it's completely obscured by these trees. And so he doesn't have many people. I mean, once you get inside this place, it's great. It's a beautiful little shop, and it's a beautiful cafe. You can just hang out in there all day. But no one can find it.
No, but he's not, like, been turned on to Wai Mai? I mean, is he, like...
No, well, he's... I think they actually have, well, too. So the interesting thing about that shop is that it's across the street from an enormous skyscraper called the Center. Where it's like Ogilvy a lot of the marketing firms.
I've spent some time in that
there.
Building, right?
And so I think he was naturally thinking, well, you know, on their lunch break they'll come and eat my sandwiches. But the problem was that a lot of folks weren't interested in eating sandwiches. They wanted some cheaper food.
Damn. So you've lived in Shanghai now since 2010, but you've also traveled pretty widely in China. What is there that's particularly Shanghainese about the characters and the stories in your book? I mean, you know, you can talk about a couple of the other guys. I mean, we don't want to spoil it for everybody, but, you know, Auntie Fu, Mr. Clean, Wang Xuesong. If you were to, write a similar book about people on a street in Beijing, would it come off really differently?
I don't think so. Honestly, okay. I the answer to that question is that I don't think there's anything specifically Shanghainese about any of the characters that I write about. I went into
a couple of them are white Yiren, so I guess that.
Well, yeah, and a couple of them are Shanghai Ren, Garbendia, one of them doesn't speak Mandarin. He speaks Shanghainese.
Oh wow.
Yeah.
Do you?
I don't.
Okay, so how did you?
No, when I was visiting, I had my assistant with me.
Oh wow.
She's from Shanghai, so she was translating, and that's actually Mayor Chen, who is the unofficial mayor of Meggie Lane. The plot of land that has this really interesting history that still continues to this day.
Yeah. So, I mean, can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, the Chen Zhongdao and Xie Guozhen and their decade-long battle against the forced demolition of their home.
So when I first moved into the Summit, which is this apartment complex that we live in, out my living room window, I have two windows on both sides of the apartment. On one side is Changlulu. Other side is this enormous vacant lot full of weeds, stray cats, rats, and these burned out homes, these shirkumen homes, these traditional homes in Shanghai. And it's almost half a block. So it's quite large. And when I first moved in, I thought, what is this?
Uh-huh.
You know, because this is a really nice neighborhood. Why hasn't this been developed? What's the story here? And when I started asking around, I kept hearing rumors. And the rumor was that someone had been murdered there. And so I decided, and the other thing was, is that there were still people inside this vacant lot living in these like half destroyed homes. And I was trying to make sense of that too, thinking, are these squatters? What is this? And so there's an entrance on Wuyuanlu, which is this street that's kind of parallel to Changlulu. And I ended up finding a time when the guard was, there was a security guard there, when the guard was on lunch, and I just kind of let myself in. And I got to meet some of the folks that lived inside, and they sort of told me the story of what had happened here. And what had happened was, when Shanghai was making way for the World's Fair, there was a lot of neighborhoods that were razed, and this was one of them. But this neighborhood was originally slated to be sort of redesigned to look like a Shirkumen neighborhood, and the agreement at first was that folks could move back into their homes there.
So they were going to destroy the old houses and then build fake
exactly,
new houses
that
looked the same.
Exactly, make a jiada Shirkumen kind of like Lilong, right? And that's not what happened. What happened was once Shanghai got the bid for the World's Fair, they changed the terms and they started offering compensation packages to the people in that lane. And they started moving them out to the exurbs of Shanghai. And of course, like a lot of these situations that we've seen over and over throughout China, especially in urban China, you know, there's always holdouts, right? And so, of course, there was this group of holdouts that didn't want to move. They wanted to stay in their home. Chen Zhongdao, you mentioned, his father had bought his home with gold. And so, you know, this was a home that you know, he strongly believed, like, I own this home. This is my home. You can't take this from me. And he wanted to at least to live in the neighborhood. But, you know, the district government of Xikui did not really agree to those terms. They sold the land to a developer, and that developer ended up using some pretty strong arm tactics to get rid of people. And one of the things that they did is they started lighting fires at the base of their homes to scare them out.
Wow.
And one of those instances in 2005 went very, very bad. And at night they set fire to one of the homes where an elderly couple was inside. They were in their 80s, and the husband had served with the PLA in the Korean War, so he was a war veteran, and they died, they burned to death.
And it was clearly the developers that had done. Did these fuckers get their comeuppance or?
Yes. Okay. So what happened after that? In 2006, there was a trial. The developer, which was, his name is Chen Kai, ended up. There were three men. Two reprieve death sentences and one life sentence.
Okay.
After that, for
was
murder.
Was this for the thugs who did it, or for management of the company?
For the thugs who did it.
Right.
It's and always the it was thugs. Not the management got off.
Right.
Yeah. And so those and what was really interesting about that case, and I'm going to go away from the Maggie Lane case here just for a second. Later on, when I started looking into what was on the land before the summit, the place that I lived in, I discovered that there was also a death by fire for that land, to clear that land.
And that explains the poltergeist activity in your home. Right? Okay.
But when I looked into that, I found there was a man who had been burned to death.
Oh, geez.
For the land that I live on. I found his widow. And she now, after that happened, she, you know, she's in the book too. Her name is Xi Guojian. So Xie Guojian is like very similar names here, but her name is Xi Guojian. Xi Guojian and her son, Zhu Weiqi, they're both characters in my book who, you know, Weiqi lost his dad and she lost her husband. But what happened was the same guy who started that fire in Maggie Lane had burned this man to death for the property that I lived on. And that Jesus. Was that happened in 1996. It happened 10 years earlier. And it was not ruled a murder. When the police said that they listened to these thugs. Uh-huh. And the thugs said, oh, he set himself on fire.
Yeah, right.
And he got off. And so ever since that day, the widow, who I profile in the book, she petitions. And she's been petitioning, you know, she's one of these petitioners. And she petitions all the way up to Zhongnanhai. So she gets arrested over and over and over up in Beijing. She goes out in front of Zhongnanhai and she throws leaflets and then she's tackled. She's taken to Majialou, which is a detention center for petitioners up there.
Yeah.
And then she's usually in there for 2 weeks, 3 weeks. They let her out. She goes straight back to Zhongnanhai and does it again. She's done this dozens of times. And her son, Weiqi, when she started doing this, he was in middle school. you know, and her son was also, you know, obviously he had lost a father and his home, right? They were given a small apartment as a compensation. So her son lives alone. He's studying by himself. And when I asked her, you know, I interviewed her 4 years ago for the first time, and I asked her, you know, I was almost scared to ask, you know, what happened to your son? He said, she tells me, oh, he's at Cornell.
Oh, my God.
And I said, he's at Cornell University? She said, in the United States? And she said, yeah. I said, what's he doing there? Well, he's getting his PhD in economics.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And so...
let it never be questioned again. The Chinese people are a resilient people.
Yeah. And so...
wow, that's amazing.
It is amazing. And this Wei Qi, he's one of... honestly, like, in this book, he's one of... he's really inspiring. I mean, this kid, he's gone through so many awful things. He was 10 years old when his father was burned to death. And, you know, it obviously had a very deep impact on him. And
now he's like
threw himself into
close
his studies.
On 30 now, right?
Yeah. And now he's 30 years old now. And he works for UBS. He's a derivatives trader for UBS in Hong Kong.
Oh, man. And I thought he turned out to be a good guy. Well,
yeah. Well, you know, he's been through a lot. And I think what he wants is economic security. And I think it's interesting. So his story is one of the stories from that section of the book. And actually, I'm doing a marketplace story that's going to air, I think, next week about him. I went down to Hong Kong a few weeks ago just to kind of check in with him again, and we did a final radio piece on him.
Let's talk a little bit about Mr. Clean. So like the U.S., I mean, China is a country where there are a lot of advertisements for health remedies, for medicines, for various, you know, snake oils, doctors, much of which is just outright quackery. And I'd like to, at this point, to remind everyone that I no longer actually work for Baidu. Now, can you tell us about Mr. tell us about Mr. Clean and his sexual potency?
Oh, man.
His sexual potency potions.
So Mr. Clean is a guy, one of the many.
Is he bald? Is that
yes.
Why you call him Mr. Clean?
He looks like Mr. Clean. He's the Chinese version of Mr. Clean. He's a retired PLA guy. He's an army guy.
Muscular
from Chengdu.
And bald.
And he's really big and he's bald. He's probably around 60 years old. I met Mr. Clean.
And virile. Very virile.
Right? Yes, he is, or claims to be. I met him on one of Auntie Fu, who is one of the main characters in the book. Auntie Fu is in her 60s. She's married. Her husband, his name is Uncle Feng. And he makes Songyobing and sells them out of his kitchen on the street.
Fucking love Songyobing.
Songyobing. His Songyobing, he charges a little extra because he thinks they're much better than anyone else's.
Are these the deep fried or the dry pan fried version?
It's the pan fried.
Okay, good.
Yeah. And so he and his wife don't like each other at all. And they bicker and they argue all the time. He's more of a practical gentleman. He believes in hard work. Auntie Fu comes from, you know, this generation. She was born, you know, around the time that China was, quote unquote, liberated. And she grew up during the Cultural Revolution, right? And so she grew up not really having much of an education. She was of this generation that sort of, you know, were sort of lost. And so she ended up.
So she believes in strife and
yes, well, struggle. Well, but you know, the one thing, you know, she was sent to you know, they met each other in a bingtuan in Xinjiang.
In Xinjiang.
Yeah. And so they were.
Okay, so let's explain just for listeners who might not know what a bingtuan is. So the bingtuan, Jeremy, you're our definer. Let's.
So they were People's Liberation Army troops that were sent to basically build stuff in Xinjiang,
yep.
Farms and infrastructure.
And to colonize.
And to colonize, right? Yeah. So there are these large military colonies, essentially, and they control very significant business interests in Xinjiang.
Yep, and they still do today.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and so they were part of a bingtuan that was established outside of Akasu in western Xinjiang province near Kyrgyzstan. And their goal there was to turn desert into farmland. And of course, this was impossible in this area, and they nearly starved to death. But they met each other at one of these farms.
Wow.
And so she, you know, she has this very romantic kind of memory of life in Xinjiang, even though his memory is starkly different. He considers it a hellhole. But she wants to go back there because I think she just cannot handle the society that surrounds her in Shanghai, this display of wealth, that everyone seems to be rich except me. What are they doing right that I'm not doing? And so she ends up getting involved in a lot of these investment schemes and a lot of these pyramid schemes. And
making herself poorer.
Making herself poor. She's dumping her pension from the Bingtuan into endless pyramid schemes. And so I write about this in the book, about this variety of schemes that she's involved in. And I go to some of these investment meetings with her. And I over and over try to convince her that these are all scams. But
isn't that violating the prime directive in a way? I mean, she just not interfere.
Well, I like her very much. She's a friend of mine, and I hate to see her. The thing is, she's not savvy, and she's a perfect target for these types of schemes because she can't get on the internet. She can't afford the internet. I can, so I'm showing her all these things that I'm finding on Baidu about the problems with these companies, right? And I print them out and I show it to her, and she still doesn't believe it.
They have that kind of thing on Baidu, don't they?
Okay, that's it, you guys.
Baidu can be pretty progressive sometimes.
Here they are. I mean,
so, you know, these were news items that I found, you know, basically saying that, okay, in this city, this company that she's investing in was found to be a scam, and all of the leaders were thrown into prison. And even when I showed her these things, she still didn't believe me. So going back to Mr. Clean, the last chapter or the second to last chapter that I write about Auntie Fu, she drags me to probably the most ridiculous investment scheme that I've seen from her. And that was a company that is a direct sales kind of company, a pyramid scheme, that is centered around selling sexual health pads that you put in your underwear. You stick them on the inside of your underwear. And the idea is that the traditional Chinese medicine soaked pads inside the pad will basically draw out all of the toxins from that area of your body.
Well, yeah. Isn't that the area of the body that naturally dispenses toxins anyway? I mean, I don't know. Maybe my
Kaiser,
autonomy.
You are correct. It is. Okay.
That's what I was told.
But the toxins that these things extract, according to the photos that they showed us at this investment meeting, and I have them on my phone. I can show you.
Oh, no. I don't know if I want to see this.
Absolutely horrible. It looked like black jelly. And, you know, they would, you know, The interesting thing about this meeting is Mr. Clean would come in, you know, I was there, Auntie Fu's there, and then there's probably six or seven other older folks like that kind of are like her, and he's got all these photos spread out over a conference table of pads before and after, and and the pads are called like these ridiculous names like Heavenly Happiness and things like that. It was the most bizarre, sad, and awful sort of meeting that she took me to.
Oh, man.
In some ways, your book reminds me a little bit of Evan Osnos's book, Age of Ambition, in the sense that, you know, many of the stories you tell are connected with people's hopes and dreams. And, of course, the Chinese dream is one of Xi Jinping's favorite catchphrases. The concept does seem to have staying power, the idea of a Chinese dream, just because of what's going on in China right now, you know, whether you look at it from the point of view of the party or, you know, ordinary people's dreams. Do you think there is a common characteristic of the people in your book in terms of what they dream about and what their hopes are?
Something that ties them together in that?
I think that the common dream that they probably share is that, except for Auntie Fu, probably because she hasn't achieved this yet, is that a lot of their dreams go beyond money. And I think that for a long time...
And this is surprising for Shanghai.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. For a long time, you know, when you look at China ever since reform and opening, the focus obviously was on money, on improving your economic status, right? For the country as well as individually. But I think we've gotten to a point, obviously, in China, especially in places like Shanghai, where people are looking beyond that now. You know, these dreams are going everywhere. They're spreading like wildfire. They're, it could be a dream of getting your child abroad to study in a foreign university, right? And setting up camp there and maybe getting a passport. It could be a dream of finding spirituality, right? CK, for example, is a good example of this. You know, CK, after having this kind of failing business for a while, becomes a devout Buddhist and finds a master and studies under this master, and really it really impacts his life. And so that's his dream.
From sandwiches to Sanskrit.
Oh, that's good, Kaiser. And then, you know, I think for someone like Mayor Chen and his wife, you know, their dream is to have their property be deemed their property, to have personal property, you know, to have rights to personal property, you know, to have equal rights, right? That means something to them.
Good luck.
Yeah, I know. Good luck with that. But I think, you know, when you're talking about the Chinese dream, in some ways, I believe that the Chinese dream and the conception of that has a lot to do with the reaction to these dreams that have kind of gone all over the place in China. And it's an attempt to corral all of those dreams, right? Probably too late. Into one dream for the nation and the party, making sure that the party is the first thing that is in your dreams, and then everything, you know, your own personal dreams can go later.
Rob, there must have been other people you considered profiling for the book, but had to leave out in the end. Can you talk about some of those people and why they didn't make the cut?
There were a couple people in specific. One of these folks was, he was a Kung Fu master who was in his 70s, and he sort of, there's a public park on the eastern end of Changlulu, and he was sort of this guy who sort of ran the morning exercises at the park, you know. And we, you know, if you've been to parks in China, you sort of know these guys, like they're kind of the ringleaders. You know, there's usually old folks dancing at 5 a.m, but he was sort of leading the Kung Fu exercises and the Tai Chi exercises, the Tai Chi Chuan exercises in the park. And I got to know him, and he was a really interesting guy. But once I broached the topic of, hey, you know, I'm writing a book, and I'd love to include you in this, he just said, no way. And I started to realize after hearing his reason that he may not be completely stable mentally, because he said, no, the Kuomintang are out to get me. And they're going to assassinate me, and so I don't want any sort of attention placed on me.
I can't imagine why you would have not included such a character.
I think I realized right there and then maybe it's a good idea that I don't include him in this book. So it's probably for the better. There's another gentleman that runs a clothing shop that's actually not too far from where Joshua Ling has her flower shop, and this guy he's a local. And he's gay, and he runs this shop, and he's just a delightful man, and I visited him over and over, and I really liked him. And the thing is, he has a sister who is constantly there outside. She sits on a lawn chair outside on the sidewalk, and just hangs out there. And he sits by her, and they talk all day. But once she realized that I was there to, you know, possibly write about him, she would not have any of it, and she,
because it would expose the shameful family secret of his homosexuality.
That's right.
Oh God.
Yeah, and that was unfortunate, because had she not been in the picture, I think he would have been very open to that, because he talked a lot about it. It was a very big part of who he is today, and you know, and he was pretty well off. He was pretty successful. I mean, he had a pretty good clothing shop. He actually, there's a lot of clothing shops around that stretch of the street that go up and disappear within months because they're not selling the right thing. But he actually had a pretty good eye for these things. And he was there. He had been there for a long time.
So Rob, you've worked as a print journalist. You've done radio for many years, and now you've written a book, and have been on a podcast or two. So what do you think is the difference between, let's not count podcasts here, of course, but the difference between, what do you think are the differences between these different types of media? What do you find to be the most satisfying way of telling complex, compelling stories?
Ooh, that's a really good question. I think all of them have their strengths. I think, you know, radio, for me, the reason I like radio so much is that it really boils down to the individual. You know, when you're with radio, it's such an intimate media. You know, you're speaking to one person, you're interviewing one person. And it really goes back to the original way that we conveyed information with each other. We told stories.
Talk, right.
It's exactly. The oral tradition, right? It's the original way that we conveyed any information. And I like that. I like that it gets down to the basics of conveying information. And I like the honesty in it too, because you've got a microphone, right? And in China,
that just automatically makes people honest, right?
Yeah. Well, no, but what it does is that it establishes the relationship very clearly when you show up.
Right.
You know, and I think that as a print journalist, it can be a little foggy sometimes. You know, you can show
sneaking
up
sneaking around with a notebook.
Right. No, right?
I think it
can be like that, you know. And I think I'm kind of glad I'm a radio reporter, because I like the medium, because I'm able to tell human stories, and I like doing that. And I think the human stories in China are just fascinating.
I think you got to capture the best of both, though, because you went at this from a sort of radio perspective, but then got to turn these long, sort of, you know, slowly unspooled narratives into a book, which is also, you know, gives you room to unpack and, you know, put in the context. And
that's the big limit to radio, is that you only have about 5 or 6 minutes to tell a story, and there's only so much you can pack in there.
Or 50 minutes if you're doing a podcast, which is nice.
You guys are lucky.
Yeah, we are. I mean, I love this medium. I think it's a perfect medium for, you know, storytelling.
And I think it's great.
Yeah. And you know, with that, the book is called Street of Eternal Happiness. It's getting rave reviews. It just came out. It's today launch day.
Today is
okay.
Launch?
So we're not sure when this actually goes, but today is May 17th here in New York. So congrats, man.
Thank you.
Yeah, you must be your third child now. So before we get to recommendations, I want to remind our listeners that the Seneca podcast is powered by SupChina. Check out the app and subscribe to the newsletter at supchina.com. You can follow SupChina on Twitter at SupChina News, or on Facebook at facebook.com/SupChinaNews. And on we go to recommendations. Jeremy, kick us off. What do you got for us?
There's a podcast produced by, I think, Longform, which is a magazine and website.
Yeah, Longform, yeah.
And the podcast is pretty good. I mean, it depends on the guest, of course, just like ours does. But they have long-form interviews with interesting people. So I just listened to one with Seymour Hersh.
Oh, Seymour Hersh. Right. Wow. He's an interesting, if slightly kooky and conspiratorially minded guy.
Yeah, but really wonderful voice. Very, very entertaining to listen to him.
Rob, what do you have for us?
Am I allowed to give something that hasn't been released yet?
Yes, you are.
Okay. So I'm incredibly excited. And this is something, I haven't read it yet, obviously, but it's a book that's going to come out very soon, I know, or at least later this year, maybe early next year. It's a book by Ian Johnson. And it's, I'm not even sure if I'm allowed to even talk about this yet, if he wants.
Oh, I know. We all know he's working on a book. I mean, he's been on the podcast many times, and he's a dear friend. So,
But I'm really excited to read his next book, because I know it's going to be about religion in China.
Right.
And this is something that I'm absolutely fascinated by.
And he is, I mean, there's nobody who's more expert. And,
you're completely right.
And sympathetic too. I mean, he himself is deeply steeped in this stuff. Jeremy, if you or I were to write such a book, I think we wouldn't be quite as fair, because you're a flaming fucking atheist.
Right? He should have interviewed you guys for this book.
Yeah, no, he should have, man. It's not too late. Ian, give me a call, man. I'll switch. Good recommendation. Yeah, Ian, anything that Ian does, I have time for, plenty of time for. My recommendation is in an app that it's a few years old now, but I only recently revisited it. I just got myself one of them nice new iPhone 6 Pluses, and I'm delighted by it. It's a great thing to read on, and so I've been reading a lot more. I mean, I used to, you know, I don't like reading on my little iPhone, and I don't always want to haul out my iPad when I want to read. So the iPhone 6 is a terrific compromise, and the perfect app for it is Flipboard. If you haven't revisited it in a while, do so, because it's just great. It's just one of the best ways that you can get the stories that your people, you know, people that you follow on Twitter are posting, and organize it by the categories that you're interested in. I mean, it's an addictive, wonderful interface, and I cannot stop flipping through this stuff and just reading stories. It's great. Flipboard. Take us out, Jeremy.
The Seneca podcast is powered by SubChina and is produced by Kaiser Guo and me, Jeremy Goldcorn. Special thanks this week to the Council on Foreign Relations, who have generously loaned us their studio space. And of course to Anla Cheng, Soraya Darabi, and Amadeo Tumomilo from SubChina. Drop us an email at seneca@subchina.com. Visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/SenecaPodcast and follow us on Twitter @SenecaPodcast. Thanks for listening. See you all next week.